I want to discuss a topic, maybe even less as a shiur, but maybe more of a discussion topic with Mar Makomo, the sources sprinkled in. And that is the topic of simcha, of happiness. I believe the exact title was the Jewish perspective of simcha as expressed through the prism of Adar and Purim, which certainly is a mouthful. And I was thinking a couple of weeks ago, people, when they go into the rabbinate, they always ask each other, so like, what are you going to speak about? Where do you find drush material from? So the truth is, if your eyes are open to the world, there's always like a drusha waiting to happen. There's always a drusha, meaning idea about life, somewhere looming around the corner. And I was thinking about this topic a couple of weeks ago in the following context. Like most Americans, I was watching the Super Bowl with my son. We found the people on our show were very excited that the rabbi would be watching the Super Bowl, so everyone was like offering their place. That was like the great excitement was to have the rabbi, you know, come watch the Super Bowl, et cetera, et cetera. So we were watching the Super Bowl. So people were watching the game, or they heard about the game, so they know that towards the end there was this very, very exciting play, called the most probably famous catch in the history of the Super Bowl. So my son, who's right at the cusp of becoming a sports fan, he's like 9 years old, his enthusiasm was just, it was unbridled. It was like this unbridled excitement, and he jumped off the couch. I was pretty excited myself, to tell you the truth. And he went like jumping into my arms. And it was just like the greatest like day, it's not like the greatest day of his life. And you begin to think about and recognize that every emotion that exists is something that finds an expression, something that finds a venue within the world of Yadus. And that's something which I believe for us is very exciting about Judaism, that we don't take an emotion and say that emotion should not find expression, that emotion is something which is invalid, but that the beauty of Yadus is that somehow it finds expression in the realm of experiences. There's a very, very beautiful idea brought down in the Meshi Loach, which was the Rebbe of Ishbitz. So he said, "The Torah is Hashem Tamima Meshivas Nefesh," that the Torah is complete because it is Meshivas Nefesh, because it gives comfort to the soul. So what exactly does that mean? So what the Meshi Loach said is that the Torah is complete because everything that a person needs, Meshivas Nefesh, the emotions can be experienced in that which is acceptable in Judaism. A person has issues with anger, so then hopefully the Torah, hopefully Judaism finds a way of dealing with that issue. A person has a problem with whatever the entity is, whatever the issue is, somehow there's a solution, somehow there's an expression, an emotion that can be expressed, that is Meshivas Nefesh. The Torah itself, hopefully, we always have confidence, allows for the full expression and expression of emotion. And that's certainly true by simcha as well. We don't tell a person, we don't tell a child, you want to feel senses of elation, therefore that should be negated, but that itself finds expression as well. There's a very beautiful Sefer Chinuch, and the Sefer Chinuch says in the context of the mitzvah of Sukkah, that we know there is a specific mitzvah of simcha when it comes to the holiday of Sukkot, more so than Pesach, more so than Shavuos, more so than any other holidays. V'hayisa ach sameach v'samachtem lifnei Hashem. There's a special mitzvah of simcha, of rejoicing by Sukkot. So the Sefer Chinuch says, in the context of that mitzvah, that there is a recognition that every person needs to feel elation, every person needs to give voice to elation. And the goal of the Torah is to do so in the context of coming to Yerushalayim. But the starting point was that there's a recognition of the human psychological needs of the person. And then the Torah's goal almost is to find an outlet, a venue for those emotions. And that's what was done by Sukkot. The question is, as we approach the holiday of Purim, and Adar is a time of Mishenichnas Adar Marbim B'Simcha, and Laihudim Haisa Ora V'Simcha, etc., etc. So what then are approaches discussed either in Chazal, in the Gemara, or in the Rishonim, in the Acharonim, the early sages, the late sages, that identify the almost the proper way of giving voice to rejoicing? What are the ways that are expressed this value of Simcha? So what I want to do is take the opportunity to maybe develop or mention three different approaches that I believe for me certainly are meaningful and hopefully will be for you as well. You know, the first approach is that which might be described as Refersh's approach to Simcha. Anybody know, just out of a show of hands, where are places in the Torah where specifically there's an obligation to have Simcha involved, where part of the mitzvah involves Simcha? Please? Right, so that's definitely true. So that's not in the Torah, but that definitely is in fact a mitzvah. And people are probably aware of the famous Gemara in Ksuvos that discusses, again, I'm not exactly sure how the weddings were conducted, but we know, Ketz Maratlif Neha Kala, how would they dance in front of the Kala? And supposedly when they would be dancing from the Kala, they would be complimenting the Kala at the same time. It's a little bit like difficult to manage, you know, most, at least for me, most men, they can't do two things at once. I don't know how they were dancing and complimenting, whatever the case is. So let's say for some reason they found that the Kala was not someone that it was so clearly how they were going to go ahead and compliment her. So it's not clear, at least on the outside, not everyone maybe perhaps found the person attractive, again, although that's insignificant in the totality of things. So basically it says that you can even lie. Simchas Chasam Akala, what's her name, I'm sorry, who said?
Miriam.
So Miriam said that Simchas Chasam Akala is something which is so significant that one can even lie about how wonderful this event is. So again, this is sort of like and this obviously ties into the famous Gemara that says that a person, people want to see a source for this, it's the Gemara in Yevamos on Daf Samechei Med Aleph, that says a person can change the truth for the purpose of Shalom. Simchas Chasam Kala was such an example that a person is even allowed to go ahead and say, you are the most beautiful, you know, whatever the case is, for exactly that purpose. And clearly that was a significant time. Okay, anybody know other specific case in the Torah where Simcha is mentioned?
You mentioned Sukkot earlier.
Right.
Ach Sameach.
So it's by Sukkot, by the holidays. Okay, anybody else know other places? What's that? By the way, when they built the base of Migdash, certainly that was described exactly. The whole dedication, something that we read in the Haftorah a couple weeks ago in Parshas Truma about the rejoicing, and they didn't want to leave, and they all had to come in front of Shlomo, and Shlomo had to almost had to sort of send them off because there was such a sense of rejoicing, and maybe in ways. I'm sorry.
Unfortunately, other cases in which I think Parshas Tetelecho is saying.
Absolutely, right. Absolutely. So that was not, that's almost the flip side of this, which we'll mention in a second, but what the Torah tells us is even in ways that are unique, by the mitzvah of Bikurim, you would bring your first fruits to Jerusalem, that's when the mitzvah of Simcha was. When they would bring Maiser Sheni is when they would have to tithe their produce, and they would bring it to Yerushalayim, to eat in Yerushalayim, or they would redeem the produce for money, right? So then, and they would have to use the money in Yerushalayim. There too, the Torah tells us a person has to have Simcha. And several other places as well. So Hirsch says that there is one common denominator by all of these things, and it's a typical Rav Hirsch idea. He said that there's been such a decentralization of the family in a community. In other words, in some sense, in a community, your life becomes so wrapped up, and Rav Hirsch speaks in such a beautiful way, in everything that is sort of decentralized from the central family, but havas bikurim, bringing the meister, celebrating in Yerushalayim the holidays, aliyah l'regel, etc., the reason that there was a specific mention of simcha was because it refers to the feeling of connection to family members, to the people in your orbit, that the simcha in Yerushalayim was an opportunity to reconnect with the family structure, and that specifically was simcha. Simcha comes when you feel connected to people around you. By Purim, we know there is, as we mentioned, a specific law of simcha. A person is supposed to feel simcha. I believe that idea of simcha is highlighted very much through a fascinating halacha. Let's say somebody comes to a Lisa's door wanting to collect money under normal circumstances. So in normal circumstances, that person shows up. If you live in a community like I do in Muncie or other places, there's a constant stream of people coming to your door. So is there any obligation to check the person's, for lack of a better word, credentials as they're trying to collect money for you? Should a person do that? Right? So anyone else? So the answer is, by all means, a person should go ahead and make sure that someone who wants money from you, that he happens to be the real deal. I don't know how long people have been, I'm not sure if I'm the longest person who's been around YU. I've been around YU for about 20 years, so you've been here for longer, but there used to be a guy collecting money in around YU, and he was collecting, he gave you a whole story about this or that, and then one time I saw him going into a Mercedes, like down like in Midtown. So here's a guy, I'd give him like hundreds and hundreds of dollars over my course of years in YU, and then I'm driving a broken down, you know, Chevy, and he's like getting picked up in Mercedes. So obviously we want to avoid circumstances like that, so there's an obligation. So how about when it comes to Matanos of Yonim on Purim? Does the same thing exist as well? So the Ritva says in Bava Metzia that when it comes to Matanos of Yonim, you're not supposed to ask anybody. That you're not supposed to go ahead and say, who is it? Are they valid? Are they this? Are they that? By Matanos of Yonim, you're supposed to give to everybody. By Matanos of Yonim, the Mishnah Berurah says you should give to non-Jews along with Jews as well. And the idea of Matanos of Yonim seems to be that it's an extension and an expression of simcha according to Rav Hirsch. That Matanos of Yonim and Purim is a day of feeling an unbridled connection, an unbridled feeling of love among people. And therefore Matanos of Yonim is an expression of that. It's not a din in tzedakah, it's a din in community and family and giving and connection as well. It's a very beautiful idea that by Purim, so we know that they attempted to separate B'nai Yisrael. So V'nahafochu, we try to do just the opposite. We try to bring together Klal Yisrael. So to some degree, I always thought that's the reason that a person, there's an obligation to drink on Purim. It's a very unique din. Drinking on Purim, people are running around. Especially if people have ever been in Eretz Yisrael for Purim. They know that the days turn into weeks already of this of a certain revelry. So my brother just made Aliyah last year from Beit Shemesh, so he used to write back articles to where they came from in Baltimore. There's a Jewish magazine there. So he wrote back about the highlight of his day of the year was Purim for him and his family. Now Purim was a day that people were just, dancing into the homes and hugging everybody in sight, maybe odd on the surface level. But the whole idea of that experience was supposed to create the simcha of connection that had been challenged. What had been challenged was the unity of the community. The specific simcha was feeling a connection with friends and family around people. Someone has mentioned to me that they got married recently and that they had, they had a beautiful wedding in a Marina del Rey, wherever the case was. And they said it was great, but maybe they had wished that their parents had saved the money on the wedding, right, and now put it towards a future home, a nest egg, et cetera, et cetera. So I told him my own experience of being married for a number of years, although it would have been nice to have helped on a down payment for a house, by all means, was that the feeling of connection to people is what allows a person to develop strength as they go on in life. As you go through experiences and the difficulty of life's experiences, it's being able to tap into moments like a person's wedding where they feel that connection to 50 of close friends, to the family, etc., that allows a person to have strength as life goes on. And that, says Rav Hirsch, is the essence of simcha as expressed by the Torah. There's another idea as well about simcha. This is something that Rav Soloveitchik developed very famously. What's your name in the back? Yeah, it was Aaron. So what Aaron said was that the Torah tells us that the why will you be punished, right? So tachas asher lo vadat Hashem Elokecha, right? B'simcha b'tuv levav. That you didn't worship God with simcha, and that the key element of what simcha is an experience of being lifnei Hashem. Is that we have some type of consciousness of God's existence. That we worship lifnei Hashem. And the Rambam tells us, the Rambam says this in Hilchos Lulav, that a person that does not have a sense of simcha shel mitzvah, of rejoicing in front of God, that person will have dire consequences. If experience in religion is something which is negative, which is something which a person finds no joy in, that person has dire consequences. Now, how in our own lives do we fulfill this experience or this mandate of being lifnei Hashem? For many people, it's easy. There's a sense of religious ecstasy, religious enthusiasm. There's a sense of connection, of a daily connection to God, to Kadosh Baruch Hu. But maybe in other ways, maybe in even in deeper ways, how does a person live a life where they fulfill this mandate of being lifnei Hashem. And I believe that there is perhaps three different approaches mentioned in the Acharonim and the later authorities about how does one experience a sense of being lifnei Hashem. So the first is something that was mentioned by Rav Tzadok HaKohen. The Rav Tzadok said that why is Yushalayim such a focal point? Why is everything revolves around Yushalayim? So the easy answer is what we said before about the Beis HaMikdash. That's certainly true. But even beyond that, being in Yushalayim allows a person a certain depth of thought, a certain insight of thought into issues of the soul and issues of life. And Rav Tzadok said the specific command of Simcha of Yushalayim is because Yushalayim creates an environment of depths of understanding. And when a person has those moments of a depth of thought, of a depth of connection to something real in life, that's the Simcha Lifnei Hashem. You know, Kara mentioned before that my wife and I are expecting our fourth child. So I mentioned a somewhat personal thought. So we thought we were expecting a couple of weeks, but we've basically been in and out of, you know, the hospital the last 2 weeks because, as usually is the case with these things, things are never simple. Births are never simple. Kids are even less simple, and then they get even more complicated as time goes on. People have had the joy of teens and preteens and post-teens and post-post-teens. I'm not sure people can advise me later when exactly that stage comes to a screeching halt. So whatever it is, so then the whole nature of childhood is complicated. So just to mention just briefly, so on a number of different occasions in the last couple of weeks, we kept on thinking about if we're going to labor, they're going to do C-section, or this or that, and so basically back and forth from the hospital on a daily basis, and Baruch Hashem, everyone's doing fine, but just obviously leads to a certain feeling of uncertainty. And as I was going through this process, you know, I thought to myself, what an amazing bracha this process is. Because a child comes out, no personality really, no connection, no ability to connect. The child is a crying mass of whatever a child does. But through the process of looking for the person you want to marry, and then desiring to have children, and having children, and going through those 9 months, and going through the ups and downs of the uncertainty of pregnancy, et cetera, so by the time the child comes out, there's such a depth of connection, there's such a depth of love already, that allows you to do all the abnormal things that parents do for children. All the things that are not governed by rational thinking, what parents need to do for kids, the kids to exist. And that is all embedded through that process leading up to the point. And what an amazing bracha from HaKadosh Baruch Hu of how physiology and nature, biology was set up to allow for those realities. And if a person is miyayin, a person looks into their own life and the world and has to some degree depths of thought in their own life, so that is what Rav Tzadok described as the experience of being lifnei Hashem. There's a second element also that I believe conjures up this idea of being lifnei Hashem. The Gemara tells us in Yevamos that a man who lives without a woman lives without simcha, and so too Gemara doesn't say this, but clearly a woman lives without a man lives without simcha. And there's many cases where the Talmud gives that description, either about marriage, about other things. This is not, don't worry, anything having to do with marriage. Bear with me for a moment. The Gemara discusses that when the rain would come down, the whole world rejoices in the rain. The Gemara describes simcha in many cases. There is an amazing mashgiach Yushalayim by the name of Shlomo Volbi, who passed away roughly 2 years ago. And Rav Volbi said in his sefer, The Ali Shor, the following idea of what simcha is. Simcha is that when you take two things that are opposite, that are contrary in nature, and you're able to synthesize those two elements, the result is simcha. That's what Rav Volbi said. Man and woman with their completely often different ways of viewing the world, with different personalities, different natures, that can synthesize and harmonize and make a marriage, that's simcha. Simcha is synthesis of disparate parts. Rain, says the Medrash, is the Shemayim and the Aretz being joined by the rain. The Shemayim and Aretz, there are different elements that are joined through the Geshamim. That is the simcha that the world experiences, knowing that the heaven and earth are united. There's a very beautiful idea of Rav Schwab. Rav Schwab, we know, was, of course, the great leader of our sister community here in Breuers. Rav Schwab was an unbelievable thinker. And Rav Schwab comments on the Gemara on Brachos that says that one of the Amorayim, one of the later people who wrote the Gemara, that he was able to be so mech geula l'tfila, that means they said the bracha baruch atah Hashem ga'al Yisrael, and then said Shemona Esrei, and a smile didn't leave his face the entire day. Anybody see anything weird about that Gemara, right? I'm sure many of us said this morning Shemona Esrei, many of us said bracha ga'al Yisrael, then said Shemona Esrei. What exactly is the cause of celebration that a smile didn't leave his face the entire day? How does a person make any sense of that? Anybody maybe want to give their own thought? What was the source of jubilation of being able to be so mech ge'ula l'tefila? It's not so clear. The Rishonim don't say anything,
Gojo. Maybe one of the ideas behind davening is to daven for ge'ula. And he's...
Right.
So in a sense, the... why should he be
davening
anymore if there is
Gula? Right. I mean, it sort of like allows, the very fact that you're praying for Gula sort of allows for Tefillah, and that itself definitely could be true. So Schwab says this following idea. He says, what is Shemona Esrei? We all know, based on the Gemara and Brachos in the fourth parak, that Shemona Esrei is there instead of the Karbanos, instead of the sacrifices. We know that according to the Ramban, as opposed to Rashi, what a karbon is us basically putting ourselves almost on an altar of saying that a person wants to take the totality of their being and somehow bring that close to God. That is what a karbon is. And the Shemona Esrei is supposed to represent that same idea as well, albeit in a more intellectual, spoken form. Shemona Esrei represents the karbon of a person saying, I want to go ahead and reach beyond myself, if you will. What is the bracha of Ga'al Yisrael? That is the point of God placing himself out in the world, wanting to redeem the nation. It's almost God giving to the nation, and Shemona Esrei is the nation almost giving of themselves. And at the moment of that unity, when a person somech ul tefila, that represents the bringing together of two disparate elements. Human experience, with all and all our finite being and all our limited being, together with God desiring in his infinite being to be with the nation. And that was the simcha that the Gemara refers to. The synthesis of two elements that have no business being together. And so what I believe, and Revolvi said many times, is that the simcha being lifnei Hashem is a sense that our life has had some sense of synthesis to it. The spiritual together with the physical, the emotional together with the rational, what our body does along with what our direction in life is. To be able to bring together the disparate elements of our being, that itself creates a sense of shleimus, of completion, that is expressed as being lifnei Hashem. That's the second element. So the first element, again, is depth of thought. Second element is a sense of completion, of synthesis, of understanding that life itself is holistic in nature. That's the second element of lifnei Hashem. There's a third element as well. I haven't seen sources for this, but obviously this makes a tremendous amount of sense. Now, I used to be the rabbi before I moved to Muncie in an amazing community in Einstein, down the Cross Bronx, which should in theory be only about 8 minutes away. People know from New York it's more like could be a good two-hour trip between here and 4 miles away from here. It's really, the Einstein was one of the most amazing places for all the right reasons. Camera, can you type by the way? Okay. Einstein is an amazing place. And I remember feeling one time a tremendous sense of sadness, and it's a small story, but I believe that it ties into larger issues. There was a student there who was a big shot in the community, a wonderful person, and he was very smart, a very big learner when he was here in YU, a very accomplished Einstein, married a great girl, had a kid, a nice-looking guy, all the possible milas in life, got into like a good residency, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I remember he always, when I spoke to him, he always somehow managed in an adult way. You know, if you have kids, so your kids do it in an immature way, he did it in an immature way, sliding into the conversation his accomplishments, how he did, how this, how that. I remember one time telling me, and he sort of tried to slip it in, that he made it into AOA. So AOA, for people who know, is like the honor, like the National Honor Society for medical school. And he told me, well, whatever. And he managed to sort of like somehow, you know, people sort of slide things in the conversations that they want you to know. And then I found out afterwards that he really didn't make it into AOA, that he had to write in to get his name on it so that he could feel that he made it onto it. And meanwhile, he didn't really make it on in the first place, but he's the one guy who wants to make sure that people know about his accomplishments, and that was a midah that ran through his life. And I always reflect back on that story as something that, in a less dramatic way, is an indication of something that we all perhaps experience, and namely that is not always feeling great about the inner point of where a person's life is at. And that somehow the person themselves feels a lack of satisfaction in certain ways, then they need to somehow find that simcha in other means, by compliments, by achievement, by being recognized, in a million different fashions. And so often that is because a person is lacking something that they should have received as a child but didn't. They're lacking something that should have been there that wasn't. So instead of feeling that sense of an inner simcha, a person pursues their whole life looking for something to give that sense of completion, looking for something to fill the void that's in a person's life. And when a person experiences that, a person never experiences simcha. And to be lifnei Hashem means that I feel so good with where I'm at a person that nothing is going to impinge on that. Not that compliment or lack of a compliment, not the promotion or lack of promotion, but just based on the inner point of where my life is at. When a person experiences that, then they truly experience lifnei Hashem, that sense of completion that can allow a person to stand in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's perhaps a third approach of lifnei Hashem, of how a person achieves simcha in their life. There's a third avenue that I wanted to mention for a few minutes as well, that I believe is an avenue of simcha. So the first avenue is Rav Hirsch, family, connection, community. That's what the Rav Hirsch says, and the idea of Matanos of Yonim. The second approach is Lifnei Hashem, with three different elements, whether it be Simchas Atzmeinu, that we have our own happiness, whether it be synthesis, or whether it be depth of thinking or depth of feeling. And the third approach, I believe, is expressed through the discussion about Sukkos. Why is it, as the Sefer Chinuch said before, that Sukkos has the element of simcha, of more simcha? So let's mention these two different quick ideas. So one idea is the Kli Yakar. The Kli Yakar said, and he says this in the Chumash, that Sukkos is very practical. Sukkos is a time of payday, right? Everyone's always happier on payday than not on payday, so therefore Sukkos is the reflection of that. How's the day payday? Our life is obviously removed from agricultural issues. You know, it rains. Usually for most of us, when it rains, we're annoyed about it, but certainly in Eretz Yisrael, you know, rain is a tremendous source of simcha. So Sukkos is the holiday of the gathering of the food. So that's why there's a special entity or special element of simcha. Very practical, but common sense idea. Rav Tzadok says more than that. And Rav Tzadok says very beautifully that I believe for all of us here, what we experience at the end of Yom Kippur, where we feel almost like a new renewal on life a little bit, where we feel when you walk out of Ne'ilah, that abnormal feeling of like that weightlessness, that you can go run like a marathon, a half marathon, a few blocks maybe, whatever the case is. So that's a feeling of the weightlessness of the post-Tshuva experience. So when you go into Sukkos in that context, so that's a sense of simcha, because you feel that sense and the impact, the cleansing impact, if you will, of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, the days that came before that. But I thought to say perhaps was something a little bit different. What I thought to say was that there's a need for us as people, individuals, I've never seen this idea anywhere, feel free to reject it or be critical of it. There is a need for us to experience a physical action, a physical reflection on an emotional reality of a person's life. Rosh Hashanah, the shofar, is something which largely is passive. It largely conjures up emotions of regret, of sorrow, of complexity. That's the whole idea of the tefillah of the shofar. V'aser Yimei Tshuva, in theory, those 10 days are days of introspection. And Yom Kippur is almost a day where you're trying to slide through the closing doors. It's a day where you're trying to lay it out on the line. What Sukkot is the physical expression of those thoughts of tshuva. It's the lulav and the etzrog, where we decry or decree with our actions that God is king, which is something that we were saying with our lips. It's moving into the sukkah, where we're supposed to experience physically the emotions that were hopefully supposed to be experienced spiritually during the Seder Yom Teshuva. It's creating one's own religious destiny through their own actions, as opposed to something which is passive or just thinking or just emotional. It's the bringing into the full force and creating one's destiny through their own behavior. And that is simcha. Simcha is a sense of creating one's own religious or emotional destiny as people, as expressed through the lulav and etzrog, and as expressed through sitting in the sukkah. There's an amazing medrash that tells us that when Bnei Yisrael went to, at the end of Yom Suf, that was the clearest moment of prophecy and the clearest moment of simcha the nation ever experienced. And it should be obvious why that is. Here it is, you're released, you're terrified, people are breathing down your back, you make it through the sea. Imagine the elation on the other side, of course. But I think specifically that elation was an expression of that same idea. The Jews came to the Yam Suf, and apparently what do they want to do? What was the impression of what the Jews wanted to do standing at the Yam Suf? Just what we read a few weeks ago in B'Shalach. They wanted to eat, so some people wanted to go back, that was certainly true. Okay, what did Moshe Rabbeinu want to do? He wanted to daven, that's what Rashi says, right? And God said, forget davening, this is no time to be so religious, go weiter through the sea, go forward towards the sea, and that's it. And there's a question that always bothered me. Throughout the Jews' exile, tefillah, prayer, was the way to go. Nachmanides, the Ramban, tells us that the Jewish people were only released in Egypt because of tefillah, because of the tzaakah, because of the crying out. Now they get to the Red Sea, tefillah should still be appropriate, and Moshe is told, forget davening, go forward. So I always thought to say was that at this moment, the nation needed to create their own destiny. Up to this point, as Lisa said before, they wanted to go back. They saw themselves, as Ibn Ezra said, as slaves, with no ability to make their own destiny in the future. And at this very moment, tefillah was not the right response. It was hisyat zvu, it's stand up and go, march forward, bring about the destiny of the people, create your own destiny, obviously with the help of God, in becoming a nation. And it was on the heels of that that Bnei Yisrael felt that sense of elation and nevuah, because it wasn't something that came about through a passive response, but through an active response. And I believe in closing that that is the essence as well of Adar, of Purim. You know, they said years ago that they showed, I'm not sure if it was on Yeshiva Torah or maybe on a college campus, they showed the Purim story to a number of college students they never exposed to before. And they were asked to give their reaction to the Purim story. Now, if you never saw the Purim story and you just read it, what would probably be your first reaction to it? The entity, the whole conclusion of the Ten Prakim. Anybody? It would probably be a little bit bloody. It's a little bit vengeful. It was a little bit bloody. It was a little bit, I wouldn't say use the word excessive, but certainly Bnei Yisrael let out all their, repressions onto Shushan and beyond that as well. But I believe it was Simcha, which was a manifestation of people who felt without rights and without an identity, without a sense of national identity, forging their own identity through the Purim story. And that's often the Simcha that's expressed. Lahudim ha'isa'or v'simcha, it's because of that forging of one's own national identity. And I believe just, again in closing, for us as people, if a person feels in their own life that they are no longer driving the ship, things are happening outside their control, they're not forging an identity for themselves, which is an expression of who they think they are and what their strengths are as people, and who they are, really are, lies dormant as life happens around them. There's no opportunity, there's no expression for simcha under those circumstances. Simcha is when a person says, I know who I am. I'm bringing about an identity which is an expression of those abilities and those skills, and a person truly achieves simcha in his life. So let me just wrap up again. We mentioned simcha is a value that needs to exist. The Sefer Chinuch says that simcha is there, and it's a matter of finding an expression for it. We mentioned that perhaps there's three major avenues in our own life of experiencing simcha: family, connection, friends. That's the Rav Hirsch model, the Purim model, etc. The second idea is lufnei Hashem. And lufnei Hashem that perhaps is expressed either through depth and through insight, A, B, through synthesis of the disparate parts of our existence, or C, through feeling shalem and an inner simcha that cannot be impinged upon. That's the second category of lufnei Hashem. And the third category of that, a person creates A, the national identity, but the personal identity, and they feel that personal identity is an expression of who they are as people. That is the simcha experience in Purim, and the simcha experience by ourselves as well. I want to thank you very much. We should all live lives of simcha. People at any point want to either criticize or comment on the shiur, my email address is blast@yu.edu, and look forward to spending future times learning together. Thank you very much.